Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Please help the world.
Please help save the world.
Yes.
Video clips of children from around the world open the Global Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen today. Delegates were told that the meeting is the last best hope to do something to curb greenhouse gases, and U.S. delegates are arriving with talk of commitment, but no legislation from Congress. Well, today, here at home, the Environmental Protection Agency is declaring greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide a danger to human health, which means they must be regulated, and that could have a far-reaching and quicker effect on the U.S. economy and Congress than anything that comes out of Copenhagen. Let's start with that news. Jeffrey Ball is environment editor and columnist for The Wall Street Journal. He's in Dallas. And Jeff, the EPA is declaring carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases an endangerment. Remind us, why is that language important?
The reason that it's important is that a declaration like that allows the EPA to, for the first time, regulate emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases. It's worth remembering that CO2, as it's known, is produced whenever fossil fuel, such as coal or natural gas or oil, is burned. And so as a result of that, it's essentially a byproduct of effectively most economic activity. Historically, that has never been regulated. Other sorts of pollutants, the kind that cause, say, smog or lung problems, have been regulated by the EPA. Regulation of CO2 has not existed, and so that's what's likely to happen or what's possible to happen.
Right. And they're saying they have the mandate, but the question, as you write, is will it happen? The EPA and the White House both saying today that they prefer Congress act first. Now, let's remind ourselves, Congress is debating cap and trade legislation, which would cap allowable greenhouse gases and then let businesses buy and sell credits to meet the cap. In other words, they may still be polluters, but they'd have to pay for it by buying credits. That legislation stalled in the Senate. So is today's move by the EPA a way of saying to Congress, if you think cap and trade is restrictive, wait till we regulate?
Yeah, I think it's exactly that. There's clearly a sense on the part of the Obama administration, which has been very public about its intent to regulate greenhouse gas emissions, that it wants to do it one way or another. There were expectations that the Senate might act earlier already to regulate, to legislate against greenhouse gas emissions. That has not happened. And so one way to read the announcement that the EPA is going to regulate greenhouse gas emissions is that it's essentially a move by the Obama administration to impose a hammer over the head of U.S. industry that says, if you do not line up behind congressional legislation, which in the end is likely to be easier on you, then you will face the backstop of EPA regulation, which you may like even less.
Well, and doesn't it also give President Obama and other U.S. officials something to hold on to when they go to Copenhagen?
Absolutely. I mean, one way to read the Copenhagen conference, which, as you say, starts today and runs for the next 2 weeks, is as an examination of the U.S. There's a dynamic at Copenhagen, which is the put very simply, the rich world versus the poor world. Although the vast majority of greenhouse gas emissions in the future are expected to come from developing countries like China and India, and not from the U.S. or Europe, the degree to which the world collectively moves to regulate greenhouse gas emissions is likely to depend to a great deal on what the U.S. does. And so Obama is going to Copenhagen. He will not be able to say definitively what the U.S. is going to do because the Senate has not acted and the EPA has not put details out on what it's going to do. But being able to say at Copenhagen that the EPA is going to regulate will give him more power, essentially, at Copenhagen than he might have had if all he could go and say was that the Congress perhaps might do it.
Right. And Jeff Ball, just look in your crystal ball in the few seconds we have. What do you think will happen if the EPA ends up having to be the one to do this, wield that hammer? I would assume it would take years in court when people fight the regulations. Do you think that this is actually going to push Congress before the EPA takes that move?
Well, I mean, it's interesting to see businesses' reaction to this. A few years ago, there was quite a lot of U.S. industry that was publicly very opposed to the entire notion of limiting greenhouse gas emissions. And there are still a number of businesses who espouse that view. But it's interesting to see that the kind of center of industry view on this has shifted toward a more nuanced point, which is that it wants Congress to act to regulate greenhouse gas emissions rather than the EPA.
Well, sure.
Again, because it feels like it will get a better deal right. under congressional action. I think one thing to watch is the details of this. That is, even if the EPA does move, how does it move? Because the details of
Jeff
this
Ball,
are
going to... We're going to have to stop you at that, and we will watch for those details with you. Jeff Ball of the Wall Street Journal, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, also this week, President Obama will receive his Nobel Peace Prize, which reminded us of the 2006 winner, Bangladeshi economist Muhammad Yunus, whose Grameen Bank pioneered microcredit, giving very small loans to very poor people, usually women, to help them start businesses. Yunus famously said, thanks to microcredit, his grandchildren will have to go to a museum to know what poverty once was. But two new studies by economists affiliated with MIT are showing that microlending may not be the cure-all Yunus hoped for, with just pockets of success. So what's going on? Jonathan Murdoch is a professor of public policy and economics at New York University and a co-author of Portfolios of the Poor, How the World's Poor Live on $2 a Day. He joins us from the studios of NPR in New York. Jonathan, you've been studying microlending for 15 years. Now we have this, some would say, disappointing data. First of all, is this heartbreaking for you?
You know, my colleagues and I have been following microfinance for a long time and feeling that the hype has gotten ahead of the evidence. I think we've got a long way to go to sort out exactly what's going on, but I wouldn't say heartbreaking.
Well, critics of the study say it's too soon to tell. There hasn't been enough years out from microlending to see how it works. Also, the anecdotes that came ahead of the hard data are so terrific, and they include the one about how Muhammad Yunus even decided to do this. He met a poor woman who made bamboo stools. She didn't have the 22 cents per stool it cost for the bamboo, so she borrowed that from merchants who then sold her stools and only gave her 2 cents. And Yunus said, for want of 22 cents a stool, I can lend her that. And, you know, off they went. So that was the hope and the promise that people could, you know, not be held hostage to lenders. Let's look at each of the studies. What else did they find?
These studies do something really important, which is instead of telling those best case stories, they're looking at average impacts. And that's something important to remember. So the first study was done in the Philippines. And there, the two scholars, Dean Carlin and Jonathan Zinman, randomized who got access to loans by taking people who had originally been rejected and giving them a second chance. What they found was that getting a loan did not increase business revenues, did not increase household savings, income, or consumption, or broadly measured psychological well-being. So a whole series of impacts that you'd expect to see weren't coming through on average.
Well, they also found that people in that study more than likely spent the money on a big ticket item like a wedding or for paying off debts. In other words, it didn't translate, as you said, into health or education or certainly starting a business.
I think this is one of the things that we're moving toward to try to understand and see that when people are looking to banks, they're not just looking to fund businesses, but as you're saying, to pay for health costs, to pay for social expenditures, to keep their kids in school, to put food on the table. That's the conversation I think these studies are moving us toward. Yunus started with something very powerful, funding those small businesses, but we're starting to see the story is changing.
Right. It's not like people were throwing away this money. It's just that they had other serious needs for it.
Yeah, I think that's right. We're starting to understand this as broad finance, just like you and I need to run our lives. Poor households really aren't that different. And we're also seeing that not everybody wants to have a business. Not everyone can run a business well. That's what these two studies are doing for us and helping us to reimagine next steps.
Let's take a look at the second study. It was done again through MIT with a microcredit bank in India. Now, in this study, there were some encouraging signs. People at least seemed to be saving for a business. And it had the effect, it seems, of creating a more positive shift in attitude about money if they could get these loans. For instance, they spent less money on alcohol. But again, the factors like did family income go up, did spending rise, they didn't.
Yeah, that's right. This is a really interesting study. It looked at a microfinance institution that was expanding in the slums of Hyderabad. They found no average impact on household expenditures, on healthcare, on education conditions, or on women's empowerment. But they did find some intriguing and, I think, encouraging results. So if you didn't have a business, you were now more likely to open a business once you had access to capital. If you had a business, your profit went up.
And so let's get to some of the overarching ideas that are now coming to the forefront in the wake of these two studies. You mentioned, first of all, that a lot of people don't want to start their own business. Being an entrepreneur is tough. And some people are saying what's far more needed is to move jobs into some of these areas. And critics are saying one of the problems with the huge success of microlending is that it sort of made everyone think the job was done. They didn't have to look at other things.
I think that's exactly right. This intervention was offered as a solution to lots of problems, and we're seeing that it's a solution to some specific problems. The big issue for so many people, even if they have jobs, is they need ways to save, they need ways to borrow when crises come up. So they still need banks. So I think one of the key things to hold on to is that Yunus had it right, that banking is incredibly important for poor and low-income people. I think he was too limited in focusing on getting loans out there to fund small businesses.
The title of the book you co-authored is Portfolios of the Poor. It implies that they need a range of services. What do you envision?
What we envision is, in many ways, I think what Grameen Bank has evolved into. One of the key things they did was to introduce a whole new suite of savings products and some insurance products, which have turned out to be massively successful. And in many ways, turn this original idea of microcredit on its head.
Well, tell us more about that, because the subtitle of your book is How the World's Poor Live on $2 a Day. Can you buy insurance when you're living on $2 a day? You introduce us to people that you met who are living on $2 a day, and you say they have a financial structure.
So we got to know a household in Bangladesh, Hamid and Khadija. Hamid is a rickshaw driver, but he's a backup rickshaw driver. And his income just bounces up and down throughout the week. Some days he might get the car and he might be able to earn $10. Then he might have a week earning nothing. The challenge for Hamid is how to stretch that $10 throughout the week and possibly the next week. For poor households, that's where all the stress is and that's where all of their focus is.
Well, and it breaks out on a balance sheet. In fact, you've done it. Hamid and Khadija's closing balance sheet in November of 2000. They've got $16 or so in a microfinance savings account. They've got $8 savings with a money guard. That's where you give money to someone else that they hold on to for you. They've got $76 in life insurance, $40 that they've lent out, $2 cash in hand, that's $2 that he keeps in his pocket to deal with anything that might happen on the road, $30 sent for safekeeping to his parents. They have a real financial structure.
Yeah, what's so interesting about them is that they, like so many of the other families we met, they're thinking about it all the time. They're very active. They're quite sophisticated. Like you said, they have an insurance policy. They own it, and they've been putting into it because they understand that, you know, life is fragile. In fact, they understand it much more than many richer people. And so a lot of the ideas that we had going into the project turned out to be completely flipped over. It's easy to think that Hamid and Khadija, who earn $2 a day on average, can't save. But about six of those different mechanisms that you just described are savings devices. They save because they're poor, not despite being poor. They have a portfolio because they're poor, not despite it.
We've been speaking with Jonathan Murdoch about how microlending is turning into something bigger, microfinance. Instead of focusing on small loans to poor people to start businesses, banks like Bangladesh's Grameen Bank are offering savings accounts and selling insurance to very poor people. Jonathan Murdoch is a professor of economics and public policy at NYU and an expert in microfinance. And Jonathan, we were talking about why banking services are even more important to the poor than the well-off because their incomes are so uneven. You gave us the example of Hamid and Khadija and a Bangladeshi couple living on $2 a day. One of the ways they save is a money guard. They have a friend hold $8 for them, and they're holding $20 for someone else. What is this money guard?
It's really the simplest thing in the world. It's that, you know, temptation is always there. It's your own temptation. It's your spouse coming around asking for money, maybe a friend. And the one way to keep temptation at bay is to get money out of the household. And so Haman and Khadijah, they ask other people to hold money.
And again, holding $20 for someone else because apparently there was someone in that home that they were afraid was going to spend it. As you write, two neighbors seeking a way to keep their money safe from their more spendthrift husbands and sons. But so what are you suggesting? Are you suggesting that there should be banks that do the service? And is there enough in it for banks to hold on to $8 for someone?
What we're suggesting is that policymakers, bankers, philanthropists embrace something that's already happening, which is that poor households are saving. They're looking to build a financial life. They're not necessarily just focused on growing a business. And you know, around the world today, we're seeing more and more innovation in this direction. And what we're suggesting is that that is the future of microfinance.
But as to the second question, you know, is it worth it for the bank? Can these people who've been having their neighbors hang on to money afford to pay fees? Or can banks afford to calculate interest on $8? Is that a sustainable system?
There are really two responses. You're absolutely right that the big challenge for the microfinance institutions is managing costs. Making a simple $100 loan can cost as much as $30 for the bank that has to do all the paperwork. So you're right, and taking savings deposits is also difficult. But it turns out that new technologies, ATMs, smart cards, mobile telephones even, are giving some ways to reduce costs. And second, banks are seeing these deposits as stable forms of capital that they can then use to lend out to other poor households or even to richer households. So it can be an important and viable part of a business model. But more important, providing savings turns out to be a very powerful potential tool to help families build up assets, create buffers, deal with health crises, etc. The other thing that we saw that was really interesting is that people are willing to pay to save. And this is a big shift because for us, we expect to be paid to save. We expect to get interest when we put money in our local savings bank. But poor households don't have that luxury. And we see them paying as much as an interest of 30% on an annualized basis for the services of someone who comes around and takes deposits. So people are already spending a lot of money to get financial services that work for them. There is a business model.
Well, but you've been saying for years that not all microcredit is the same and that some of it can never be self-sustaining. It will always require a subsidy.
I think when we think about the future of financial services for the poor, there are really two things to hold on to. One is creating new banks that are more responsive and have products that are more relevant for poor households. The second part is figuring out the business model. For a long time, people like Muhammad Yunus have said, you know, this is not just good social action, it's also great business. And people have been excited about the fortune at the bottom of the pyramid, which is a phrase that gets used a lot. We see, in fact, when we look at the data more carefully, you can make money when you're serving better off households. It is much harder to make money when you're making those small transactions, as you mentioned, and you're working in much more remote areas where the costs are higher. So we see a landscape where part of it is going to be for profit and part of it is going to be subsidized. I think we should embrace subsidy if it's delivering the goods. And that gets us back to the question, you know, that was raised at the beginning where we're talking about the impact studies. If we're going to embrace subsidy here, we also need to be committed to serious impact studies like these ones. And when they're not giving us the results that we are expecting, we need to take that seriously and think about next steps.
That's Jonathan Morduck. He's professor of public policy and economics at NYU, also a co-author of Portfolios of the Poor, How the World's Poor Live on $2 a Day. And he's director of the Financial Access Initiative to bring quality financial services to poor people, more than just microlending. And Jonathan, just want to ask you one quick question. You introduced us to some of the people that you met. What's that like to walk into someone's house who lives on a dollar or $2 a day and sit there and itemize what they do? What do they think of that?
Well, at first they think, who is this person? I'm not going to tell them anything. And in South Africa, where we looked at this carefully, it turned out that it took months to gain trust. It took months to really have them feel comfortable with us and, you know, for us to feel comfortable asking the right questions. And after that, they became really excited about sharing and talking. For many people, they didn't really have a chance to talk about these issues. Even though they were really important, there was no one really interested in sitting down and going through all the basics.
Did any of them speak to you about, you know, an awareness that a dollar a day is something that many people in the Western world might spend on half a coffee.
That's really not how most people are thinking about their world. Mm-hmm. They're really thinking about their community and how they're doing relative to their neighbors and their family. They're really not thinking about those global inequalities. Because once you start thinking about it, it is confusing and challenging just as it is for us. I mean, it's very hard for us in the richer countries to imagine how, you know, 40% of the world's population lives on under $2 a day, 2.5 billion people. It just boggles the mind. It's very hard for us to get around that kind of number. And I think it's really the same for people in poorer communities. Hard to imagine how we can be so rich and what it must be like to live on so much.
Jonathan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
We interrupt this broadcast to bring you this important bulletin from the United Press. Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
A radio broadcast from December 7th, 1941, the day that will live in infamy. After the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, the country rallied behind President Franklin Roosevelt and the U.S. entered the Second World War. From enlisting in the armed forces to buying war bonds or planting a victory garden, it seemed every American came up with some way to help the war effort. Producer Nate DeMeo has the story of one man's unusual contribution.
They needed a plan. The Japanese had attacked the U.S. naval base at Pearl Harbor in Honolulu. Bullets and bombs and torpedoes had slammed down out of nowhere, killing 2,386 Americans in less than an hour and a half. The Japanese army had already rolled through much of northern and central China before the communists slowed its assault by intentionally destroying dams along the Yellow River, killing thousands of Japanese soldiers, but as many as a million Chinese citizens. The men in Washington's war planning rooms and cabinet meetings and Senate offices were nervous. These Japanese were vicious. They had already slaughtered as many as 200,000 civilians. How long would it be before they were bombing San Diego or Salem, Oregon? The Americans needed a weapon. They found a dentist. Or a dentist with a weapon found them. Anyway. On December 7th, 1941, that same day that will live in infamy day, Dr. Lytle Adams, a country dentist from Irwin, Pennsylvania, coming up on retirement age, was in New Mexico on vacation. At dusk, in a crowd of other tourists, he watched millions of bats pour out of the mouth of Carlsbad Cavern. It was incredible. On the drive back, he heard the news of Pearl Harbor, and he was ticked. And he had an idea, one that could punish the Japanese and end the war that was sure to follow the attacks. He had learned at the caverns that bats could carry more than their own weight. Females carry their young, often two and three at a time. What if they carried tiny bombs? What if you dropped millions of bats carrying millions of tiny bombs over a Japanese city? The dentist called a friend, who called a friend, who called Franklin Roosevelt, who loved the idea. The bats would be placed in containers, which in turn would be placed in other containers. Each bat would be strapped with a time bomb. The containers would be dropped from a plane and would pop open in mid-descent. And the bats, 1,040,000 of them, would erupt out. Some would burst into flames as they fell, falling onto the wooden and paper structures below. Others would scatter, finding refuge in attics and eaves, under porches, the way the bats do. And one by one, over the course of hours or days, the bombs would go off and fires would start. And people would be terrified because they wouldn't know if they had a bat in their house, because whoever does. And the superstitious Japanese, or so the dentist and the president thought, would be sure that some god was punishing them. Which was bananas, but the military worked on this idea for 3 years, led by the guy who invented napalm, arming Mexican free-tailed bats, building mock Japanese cities and burning them down. All of the tests suggested the dentist's idea would work, but wouldn't be ready to deploy until the summer of 1945. And by then, the Americans knew they would have a different weapon capable of burning Japanese cities.
Nate DeMeo, producer of The Memory Palace. Well, staying in the air, today, somewhere out in California's Mojave Desert, British billionaire and Virgin Galactic founder Sir Richard Branson will unveil his long-awaited Spaceship Two, which he hopes will soon take civilians to the final frontier.
What we want to be able to do is try to bring space travel down to a price range where literally hundreds of thousands of people will be able to experience space that have never dreamt that they'd have the opportunity in the past.
Well, meantime, the price is pretty steep, $200,000 a trip. If all goes well with the test flights, Branson and his family are scheduled to be the first Spaceship Two passengers sometime in 2011. So far, about 300 future astronauts have plunked down a deposit to reserve a seat. Each flight will carry six tourists and two pilots, gaining speeds of 2,500 miles per hour, altitudes of 60,000 feet before reaching outer orbit. Total flight time, 2.5 hours. Well, we come back down to Earth in about 30 seconds here and now. Here in Massachusetts, voters will go to the polls tomorrow in the first phase of a special election to fill what all the candidates say are pretty big shoes. Tomorrow's primary will narrow the field of four Democrats and two Republicans vying for the late Ted Kennedy Senate seat. The general election will be held next month. The campaign's been only 3 months long. Some voters are just getting to know the candidates. Here now is Fred Tizes covering the race. Fred, welcome.
Thank you.
And first of all, let's acknowledge what everyone across the country is probably thinking. This is heavily Democratic Massachusetts, but the Republican candidates are getting a lot of coverage. And some of our listeners might remember that before Republican Mitt Romney was governor, he gave Senator Ted Kennedy a run in the 90s. So is it seen as a fait accompli that tomorrow's primary is really the election to decide among Democrats?
I would not say it's seen as a fait accompli. There are Democrats out there who are worried that the Republicans could take this election because there's a lot of anti-tax sentiment. Also, a lot of seniors are very worried that this health care reform is going to take away their Medicare or reduce their Medicare coverage. I've had Democrats tell me that if the Republican candidate exploits this well enough and runs a good campaign, he's got a shot at beating one of the Democrats. Now, that said, this is Massachusetts. We have not sent a senator, a Republican senator, to Washington since Ed Brooke, and that was back in the 1970s.
Right. Well, let's take a look at the candidates. Let's start with the Democrats. You've got Attorney General Martha Coakley, who's now the front runner, and she picked up the endorsement of President Bill Clinton. He's even doing robocalls for her. How has she been presenting herself?
She is now presenting herself as she goes into this final stretch as the candidate who can do something about the economy. Now, this is something new. She's really started to focus on this theme. Throughout the campaign, I think she's tried to present herself as the capable, competent attorney general that she's been, and before that, prosecutor. She came off at the beginning as being very cautious, but that's kind of what, you know, legal people are, make sure they dot their I's and cross their T's. And then as she's gained confidence, she's demonstrated more and more passion.
Feels as if the other Democratic candidates have been trying to position her as less likely to fill the seat of the liberal lion of the Senate, that they're less cautious, and that's a good thing in that way. Let's take a look at some of those other candidates. You've got Mike Capuano, six-term congressman. The Boston Herald endorsed him. How else is he differentiating himself from Martha Coakley in particular?
One way is that he is all out for getting immigration reform passed. He doesn't think it'll happen in 2010 because the senators are going to be up for re-election. Immigrant groups are complaining that Martha Coakley has not signed on to getting immigration reform, which to them means finding a way to legalize all the illegal immigrants in this country.
Yeah. Well, then you have Ellen Casey, who founded the community service group City Year here in Boston. That became the template for AmeriCorps nationally, and he has a lot of national backing. Caroline Kennedy attended a fundraiser for him that was hosted by New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Caroline Kennedy's daughter, Rose Kennedy, at Harvard, is one of the legions of college kids who are working for Casey. He's been endorsed by the Boston Globe. So all this, you know, a lot of grassroots excitement and a lot of national excitement, but has he been gaining traction with Massachusetts voters?
Tough to say. When I look at his campaign, it looks like a very effective campaign. They've got a lot of people knocking on doors, very enthusiastic for him, and it looks like they're doing that in a way that none of the other three campaigns are. So that could help him out. When I've gone with him to talk to voters, he seems to walk away more persuaded that he's won them over than maybe I am. I'm wondering whether they're being polite or, you know, they're actually going to vote for him. So not really sure his message is getting across to people.
Well, and then we have venture capitalist Steve Pagliuca, again, on the Democratic side. It's a crowded field. He's part owner of the Boston Celtics. He funded most of his $5 million campaign with his own money. And he's everywhere. If you go to the Boston Globe's website, he pops up. We just looked at a CNN story online. There's his ad. If you Google one of the Republican candidates, Scott Brown, it sends you to Steve Pagliuca's website. How is he differentiating himself from the other candidates?
He tried in the beginning to hit what is seen as the number one issue here in Massachusetts, according to the polls, which is jobs. So that figures, here's a guy who's in business. But then about halfway through the campaign, he started going, trying to go after Martha Coakley to distinguish himself from her by saying that she would vote against health care reform if it included very strong anti-abortion language. And he has been saying that he would vote for anything that comes out of the Congress, hoping that that would differentiate him from Coakley and Capuano.
Yeah. He one of the candidates saying that health care trumps the abortion question for now.
That's right. And that doesn't seem to have helped him any. So he may, maybe he should have stuck to the original message of jobs.
They've been trying to differentiate themselves, but as you have been watching them, does it seem to you to matter which one, if one wins, wins?
I think the big difference you'll see is on this health care issue. Both Martha Coakley and Mike Capuano have said that if Congress comes out with a health care bill that expands the prohibitions on abortion, on funding of abortions with any kind of federal money, both Coakley and Capuano say they'd vote against the health care plan. Both Alan Casey and Steve Pagliuca say they would vote for it and then try to improve it down the road.
So a difference there. Well, and we want to make sure we've touched on the Republicans, as you say. Don't count them out. The front runner, 50-year-old Scott Brown, a state senator who put himself through law school working as a model. Much has been made of that. His daughter was also a contestant on American Idol. His wife is a well-known television reporter in town. He's backed by Mitt Romney.
One of the interesting things I see about Scott Brown is that he is not the kind of Republican that traditionally has won in Massachusetts. They have to run, at least, as pretty liberal Republicans. Mitt Romney did that. Scott Brown is more in the national Republican mold. He's slightly more conservative than traditional New England Republicans. So it'd be interesting to see how well that message carries here.
Then there's Jackie Robinson. He's a lawyer. He's known pretty much for running for offices. USA Today's profile of him says his biggest backer is himself.
You know, he stood out in this race by saying that he wants to have a Paris peace conference on Afghanistan, and that sounds to a lot of people like, oh my God, we're back in the days of Vietnam, you know, and that didn't really resolve very much. I haven't heard very much from him other than that he wants to eliminate the capital gains tax. So he hasn't been able to get a lot of traction.
Fred, one last question for you. We all remember the outpouring over the summer when Senator Kennedy died. And we're hearing projections of very low turnout at the polls tomorrow to pick the candidates who might replace him. Why is that?
Two things, I think. One, you know, we're in the holidays. People are thinking about getting their Christmas trees and you know, doing their shopping. And the other thing is that this is the only race on the ballot. You know, there's nothing else. It's just this one Senate race. And generally, when that happens, you get a low turnout.
Here now, Fred Tyes, on tomorrow's special primary here in Massachusetts to pick the Democratic and Republican candidates who will then compete in January to fill the late Senator Ted Kennedy's seat. Fred, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Robin.
Okay, quick note. I give. You can always reach us at our website, hereandnow.org. We love to hear from you. But now you can also follow us on Twitter at Here and Now. No cracks about Robin and tweets, please. I said, up next, the music of New Moon, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. The Twilight saga, New Moon, has grossed over $250 million in the U.S., almost $500 million worldwide. But even before the movie debuted at number one at the box office, the soundtrack hit number one on the Billboard album charts.
Meet me on the equinox. Meet me halfway. The sun is perched at its highest.
That's Meet Me at the Equinox by Death Cab for Cutie, a favorite band for the Twilight set. The CD also includes selections by The Killers, Grizzly Bear, and Radiohead's Thom Yorke. Entertainment Weekly calls the New Moon soundtrack a swooning conveyance of girl meets undead boy romance delivered by some of the best established and emerging names in the indie stratosphere. A mixtape with teeth. High praise indeed. The film was directed by Chris Weitz, but his music supervisor was Alexandra Patsavis. In fact, she's picking the music for all the film versions of Stephenie Meyer's wildly popular books. Alex is the head of Chop Shop Music Supervision in South Pasadena, and she joins us from Burbank, California. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
How do you do something like this? How does it work? Are you listening to music to hear something that works for you? Are bands lobbying you? How does it work?
Yes, to all of those things, really. I've been music supervising now since the mid-90s, and so are on many publishers, record labels, managers' radar. But every project's a different project, and we, you know, listen with fresh ears every time we're scoring a new script or film.
We understand bands were also sending you coffins and Dracula pictures.
All kinds of crazy things. South Pasadena will never be the same.
Well, did it work? I was going to say, is there a band that you might not... I mean, Death Cab for Cutie is pretty obvious.
I've heard of them, yeah.
Yeah, right. But was there somebody that really made their way through?
There were a couple of bands who made their way through, but not through the Coffin Express, unfortunately. I think Hurricane Bells really was the one band that I had never heard of at all in any way.
Wait, okay. Gotta look before you go. Wait, okay. You gotta look before you go. Deep into the darkness where I hide.
There are some other fairly new acts, though, on the soundtrack. Band of Skulls and Licky Lee, although she has been established in Europe for a bit.
Her song appears after Edward, you know, the vampire, leaves Bella at the beginning of the film. She goes into a 3-month funk. She doesn't move from her chair, and we hear Lucky Lee's Possibility.
There's possibility.
Now, Alexandra, how does this work? Is this a song that was already written? Did artists compose songs for the film, or did they already have songs?
All of the tracks are actually exclusive to New Moon, but some of the bands actually submitted already completed songs that they thought would be a great fit, like Thom Yorke. And some bands actually came into our cutting room where Chris Weitz and crew created a little makeshift screening room, and they screened a very early cut of the movie. And then Chris was able to interact with them artist to artist to talk about what the lyrics might say, what the feel of the song should be. And I think in Licky Lee's song, she came in, and I think that her voice betrays such longing. I mean, I think there's such longing and loss in that song that she definitely took away the conversation that she had with Chris and then created this song.
Well, and you also mentioned Thom Yorke. His hearing damage is used in the piece. This is when the vampire Victoria is pursuing a group of people who are actually tracking her.
That's right.
Now tell us what it's conveying.
I love that track so much. It plays almost in its entirety, which is very unusual for a movie, with very little dialogue. It's stress and anxiety and the wonder about, you know, all these supernatural creatures. I think it's a beautiful track.
Talk about the band Muse. We we have to. Twilight author Stephanie Meyer has called them rock gods. She dedicated her fourth book to them. They're her favorite writing music. Their song Supermassive Black Hole was used in a pivotal scene in the first Twilight film.
The track plays over the vampire baseball game, and it's really a love letter to the song in a way. Like, it, you know, is so loud and so grand. Muse was certainly very important to Stephanie and something that we've kept in mind and are interested in returning to them again, hopefully.
That's Muse's I Belong to You. Alexander Patsavis, we're always hearing about the death of the record industry. Less radio play, more people downloading music online. You've also scored television shows, Gossip Girl, Grey's Anatomy, The O.C. Is this a new way for the record industry to stay alive?
It's one way to stay alive, but it's not the way to stay alive. I think, although there's a tremendous amount of gloom and doom, and clearly the old ways aren't working anymore. Record sales are down, piracy up. It's a tremendous time for music because anybody with a great idea and some very inexpensive recording equipment can send in music to a music supervisor and also can sell their music online, CD Baby. There's many opportunities for music, and that's, you know, that's exciting.
That's Alexander Patsavis. She's the music supervisor for the soundtracks for the Twilight films, including the most recent, The Twilight Saga New Moon. She's also head of Chop Shop Music Supervision. This has also been tremendous success for you because Chop Shop is also your music label. So while you're scoring or doing the soundtracks for films, you're also looking for new talent. Did you find one?
Anya Marina, who actually I first used a few years ago on Grey's Anatomy, she was the only unsigned artist on the first Grey's soundtrack, has since been signed to Chop Shop, and she wrote a beautiful song for the movie.
And it does sound like that's something that could be playing in Bella's head during the film. That was her intent?
I think that was exactly her intent.
Let's listen to Satellite Heart by Anya Marina. Alexander, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
So pretty, so smart, such a waste of a young heart. What a pity, what a shame.